You're listening to a sermon from New Harvest Church in Salem, Oregon. We believe that you were created for connection to Christ and a community of his followers. This sermon is an extension of our desire to become more like Christ by engaging God's word within our weekly gatherings. If you are in the area, we'd love for you to join us on a Sunday. You can learn more about New Harvest and our ministries at newharvestch.org.
Before we jump into our topic this morning, I want to share two brief announcements. As was mentioned in the prayer, we have a partnership with our local elementary school that's just a stone's throw that direction, Holman Elementary School. And we like to serve the needs that come up in the school. And so there's two ways that we can specifically, right now, partner with Holman. The first is we run an after-school program. I think we've done this like 5 or 6 years now. And it's produced a lot of fruit. It's built a relationship between us and the community at large. And a lot of the students that started in the after-school program are now in our youth ministry, which is awesome and great. And so that relationship has continued on just past the after-school program. But the thing is, we can't do the after-school program if nobody wants to help run the after-school program. So we need some of you that are free from 3 to 5 on Tuesdays and Thursdays that would be willing to come, maybe just for one of those, but to come every week during those times to serve kids and to give them a safe place to be after school. If that's you, you can sign up in the back. You could write it on a connection card, which is in the seat back right in front of you, and give that to an usher on your way out. You can email or contact Karen about being involved with that, but we would really appreciate being able to start this program in the next few weeks, and right now we just simply can't do it. So if you would like to get involved, let us know. We would love that. The second thing is a more immediate need, because this is something that's happening next Sunday. Holman contacted us and said, we really need help with snacks. We do not have any snacks. And so we're going to collect snacks for them next Sunday. That's it. One Sunday only. Bring your snacks here. We'll have a bin that you can put them in. And if you're wondering, like, so what do I bring? There's a list that we printed out so you can take it with you to the store or buy online or whatever you do, and you can grab that list. It's in the back of the lobby right as you're leaving. Grab that list, and you can help in that way. So our text for this morning is Daniel 2. I'm really excited to join in the text that we started these last few weeks in the book of Daniel. My first job growing up as a teenager was working at Illihee Hills Country Club. And I loved the job, not because of the hours. The hours were really pretty awful. I started work at 5:30, so I had to get up at 4:30. And on the weekends, we started at 5, which meant I had to get up at 4. Really awful hours, but the great thing was I got to be outside all day, and I got free golf. So it was really a pretty easy decision at that point. I got paid, and I got free golf. It was great. But, my favorite part of the job wasn't necessarily getting free golf. My favorite part of the job was getting to meet all sorts of people from all walks of life. And I can remember a few specific guys that I worked more directly with for a few summers. There was a football player from Boise State. There was a baseball player from Western Oregon. And then one summer, there was this guy that was studying turf grass management. That's a real thing. You can get a degree in turf grass management from Oregon State. And so he was working at the golf course to really figure out, like, is this the little niche that he wanted to go down and figure that out. So I was getting to know him a little bit, and eventually I found out that he had been with his girlfriend for 9 years. 9 years! I was, like, befuddled, because I was 19 years old at the time. I'm like, how could you be with somebody for 9 years? And, like, so no offense, if you, like, are married now and you were dating for 9 years, like, that's too long. Like, if you take 9 years to figure out whether this person is the right person or not, like, I don't know. That's just too long, okay? Can we all agree on that? 9 years is too long? Like, make your decision. So I'm talking to him about this because I'm, like, so confused. I have no context for this whatsoever. How could you be with somebody for that long and not get married to them? Well, it turns out, he said, I don't believe in marriage. I think it's a cultural construct that we've come up with to tie people down and to impede on their freedoms. And so we're just living together, and we're never going to get married, and we're never going to get engaged, and that's just how it's going to be. And I'm just like, what? So he says, well, how do you understand marriage? I said, well, marriage really comes from my understanding of God. And my faith really informs the way that I understand the way a man and a woman come together. And he said, this is where it really got ugly and where the conversation began to really fall apart. He said, oh, I don't believe in God. And, you know, the Bible is really oppressive and really holds people back from being fully who they want to be and living into all of those things that make people happy. And so I just said, well, you know, I think we have two different views on this, and we're gonna have to move on. And I still was able to work with him, but we didn't talk about dating anymore, that's for sure. And really, that conversation, I think, even though it was like the first one like that I'd ever had in my life, was really a sign of things to come, a sign of things to come. And so way back in 1966, Time magazine released one of their most famous cover stories ever with the title, Is God Dead? And you can imagine that all the religious people really loved this, right? No. They got 3,000 letters in response to this title within a few months of people that were angry with what they were doing. And now it's funny to look back. This is 55 years ago. I read through the article and I actually thought, like, oh, it was, you know, fairly balanced and they did a good job. And really all they did was take the philosophies of Nietzsche and Freud and Marx and say, hey, people are starting to believe this stuff, that like God maybe isn't real. And what does that mean for our society and what might that mean for you? That's really what the article was all about. And so back in the 1960s and the 1970s, to not have belief in God was extremely rare. And so I actually have a chart that I put together, or I found, based on belief in God. The amount of people that would say they don't believe in God or don't have any religious belief has continued to climb from the early 1970s is where this starts, all the way till almost 2020 is where it ends. And you can see the increasing amount of people every decade that would say, yeah, I don't really believe in God, or at least I have no religious belief. I'm agnostic at best or atheist at worst, right? That's what it's saying. And so more and more people are saying, I don't really believe in this. And this actually impacts us as a church too. Because as society says, you know, we can live life without God. We, as believers, are then prone to actually go through life and think, yeah, it is possible to go through life without needing God. I can do this on my own. And so we're susceptible to some of those things, even if they aren't foundational to our lives. And so it used to be that you could engage with almost any person in society and have the assumption that they had some understanding of God and a higher purpose, a higher power that was kind of dictating the way that we needed to move in to life. And so we as churches and as believers, we'd invite people to come to church. Churches would put on events trying to get people to show up, all for the goal of just being able to share the good news of the gospel in a way that would hopefully cause them to say, oh yeah, I'm already kind of leaning that direction. That's what I believe in now. And so they would take this step of faith into Jesus. And so we already had the same kind of foundational understanding about life and God and our purpose. And so all we had to do is really point them to Jesus. Well, now I would say it's not quite that simple. It's not just enough to invite your friend to church. It's not enough just to fight the culture war to make sure Christianity remains prevalent in society today. There is something more that has to be done. And thankfully, I think the book of Daniel speaks to this very powerfully. The book of Daniel, which is what we've been in for the last 2 weeks, now our third week as we move into Daniel chapter 2. And the book really covers Daniel and his three friends who are taken from Jerusalem to Babylon, where they're living in exile and serving the king. And so I invite you, if you have a Bible, to turn to Daniel. If you don't, you can scroll through on your phone. If you don't want to do that, the words will be on the screen. We'll make it easy for you. In the Bible, Daniel is past Psalms and Proverbs and Jeremiah and Ezekiel. And if you go past to like Hosea and Joel and Amos, you've gone too far. So book of Daniel, chapter 2. And as you're turning there, just a quick recap of where we've been. Daniel and his three friends taken from their homeland, serving the royal family in some way that they were a part of in Jerusalem, taken to Babylon, where they're living there and serving the king. And they're put in this kind of training ground to become the king's servants, to work in the king's service. And they're in that for 3 years. And it says toward the end of chapter 1 that at the end of that time, they gain knowledge and understanding, 10 times better than everybody else that was in the program. And so the king elevated them into his service, and it even said that Daniel developed the gift of understanding dreams and visions. Now, why would God give Daniel that kind of gift? Well, we're about to find out, because that's what chapter 2 is all about. So, Daniel chapter 2, we're going to dive into 30 verses. So, sit down, get comfortable. This will be a little bit as we read through this story. In the second year of his reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. Now, real quick, the second year, I just said 3 years of training. And so this kind of reads like a contradiction in the Bible, but it's not. It was common, especially in ancient times, for the first year of a king's reign to be called the accession year, the year that they come into power. And then the second year was actually the first year. I don't know why they did it that way, but that's why it says in the second year of his reign, so that the calendar things actually line up. In the second year of his reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. His mind was troubled, and he could not sleep. So the king summoned the magicians, enchanters, sorcerers, and astrologers to tell him what he had dreamed. When they came in and stood before the king, he said to them, "I have had a dream that troubles me, and I want to know what it means." Then the astrologers answered the king, "May the king live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will interpret it." The king replied to the astrologers, "This is what I have firmly decided. If you do not tell me what my dream was and interpret it, I will have you cut into pieces and your houses turned into piles of rubble." A very rational response, right? "But if you tell me the dream and explain it, you will receive from me gifts and rewards and great honor. So tell me the dream and interpret it for me." Once more they replied, "Let the king tell his servants the dream and we will interpret it." Then the king answered, "I am certain that you are trying to gain time, because you realize that this is what I have firmly decided. If you do not tell me the dream, there is only one penalty for you. You have conspired to tell me misleading and wicked things, hoping the situation will change. So then, tell me the dream, and I will know that you can interpret it for me." The astrologers answered the king, "There is no one on earth who can do what the king asks. No king, however great and mighty, has ever asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or astrologer. What the king asks is too difficult. No one can reveal it to the king except the gods, and they do not live among humans." This made the king so angry and furious that he ordered the execution of all the wise men of Babylon. So the decree was issued to put the wise men to death, and the men were sent to look for Daniel and his friends to put them to death. When Arioch, the commander of the king's guard, had gone out to put to death the wise men of Babylon, Daniel spoke to him with wisdom and tact. He asked the king's officer, "Why did the king issue such a harsh decree?" Arioch then explained the matter to Daniel. At this, Daniel went in to the king and asked for time so that he might interpret the dream for him. Then Daniel returned to his house and explained the matter to his friends Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. He urged them to plead for mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that he and his friends might not be executed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. During the night, the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision. Then Daniel praised the God of heaven and said, "Praise be to the name of God forever and ever. Wisdom and power are his. He changes times and seasons. He deposes kings and raises up others. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to the discerning. He reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what lies in darkness, and light dwells with him. I thank and praise you, God of my ancestors. You have given me wisdom and power. You have made known to me what we asked of you. You have made known to us the dream of the king." Then Daniel went to Arioch, whom the king had appointed to execute the wise men of Babylon, and said to him, "Do not execute the wise men of Babylon. Take me to the king, and I will interpret his dream for him." Arioch took Daniel to the king at once and said, "I have found a man among the exiles from Judah who can tell the king what his dream means." The king asked Daniel, also called Belteshazzar, "Are you able to tell me what I saw in my dream and interpret it?" Daniel replied, "No wise man, enchanter, magician, or diviner can explain to the king the mystery he has asked about. But there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries. He has shown King Nebuchadnezzar what will happen in days to come. Your dream and the visions that passed through your mind as you were lying in bed are these. As your majesty was lying there, your mind turned to things to come. and the revealer of mysteries showed you what is going to happen. As for me, this mystery has been revealed to me, not because I have greater wisdom than anyone else alive, but so that your majesty may know the interpretation and that you may understand what went through your mind. And this is the word of the Lord, a long word of the Lord for us today in a really amazing and compelling story. And if you're like, well, what's the dream? Well, you're going to have to come back next week, because that's what we're going to look at next week, is what the dream actually was. And so for the last 2 weeks, we have really set the foundation for the book of Daniel. Daniel as a man of character, a man of integrity, and who conducts himself in a way that honors the Lord. And he shows this in two ways in chapter one, which we looked at the last 2 weeks. First, he passed the test. He did not compromise his obedience to God. He passed the test. And then secondly, all the negativity around trying to strip their identity as Israelite men who were wanting to be people of God was trying to be ripped away from them. All of that stripped, given new names, all sorts of ways. And Daniel kept his identity rooted in the Lord. And so we see right here from the very beginning that God chose Daniel not just because he was gifted. As it says, he was given the gift of visions and dreams and understanding them. God did not choose Daniel just because he had those gifts. He chose Daniel because he was a man of character also. And the both of them go together as to why Daniel would be put in this place, this high place, this high calling for this time before the king. It's because of both gifts and character that come together in Daniel. That's really the backdrop for all of this. And so the story really begins with the dream, with the first few verses. The king has dreams, multitude of dreams, as it says, and he wants help interpreting them because he's having trouble sleeping. And so he calls for the magicians and the enchanters, the sorcerers, and the astrologers. It's basically all the knowledge and wisdom and scholarship available in Babylon at the time. He calls them in and he wants them to figure out what's going on. It's kind of like a group of like really smart people and then like palm readers and like horoscope people. It's kind of like a weird mix, right? Like most of these people, I wouldn't think, oh, they might be able to help me. But this was really valued people in Babylon, because they had a belief in many gods. And one of the groups of people, and your Bible might even have a little footnote that says this could also be translated Chaldeans. One of the groups is probably the Chaldeans. And history actually tells us a lot about the Chaldeans, because they were a really influential group, especially at this time in Babylon. And one of the things that they were known for is having what we might call dream books. And so people would go to the Chaldeans over a long amount of time and say, hey, I had this dream, and they would write down the dream, and then they would track the person for many years trying to figure out what was the outcome of the dream and what was the outcome of that person's life. And so then they would take notes of all of that. And over the course of many decades, many years took place, they had a whole literature available to where somebody could go to the Chaldeans and say, hey, I had this dream, here's what the dream was about, and the Chaldeans would say, well, here's what's going to happen. Here's what's going to happen in your dream. And so the Chaldeans show up before the king, and they're like, yeah, we're ready. We got our books. We're ready for you. Tell us the dream. And they're kind of obviously befuddled by the whole thing. What does the king say when they're not willing to interpret it? He says, if you do not tell me what my dream was and interpret it, this is verse 5, I will have you cut into pieces and your houses turn into piles of rubble, which is a rather shocking statement. Just like, he's asked for something impossible, right? Like, who knows how to interpret a dream that, you know, nobody's told you about? It would be like me going to you and saying, hey, do you know what I'm going to eat for dinner next Friday night? You'd be like, how on earth could I possibly figure that out? No, if you knew me really well, you would know the answer's pizza, because that's what I'm going to have on Friday night, because that's what I always have on Friday night. That's what my kids expect. But, you know, nobody can predict that sort of thing, right? That's what their response is. And so I think the question that I have of this story is based on all of this. Why did the king want them to tell him what his dream was? Why did he do that? And there's a couple explanations that historians and theologians and Bible scholars have come up with. The first is the king has asked him to tell him what the dream is because he doesn't remember it himself. He doesn't know what the dream is, and so he actually needs somebody to tell him because he doesn't remember enough about it. And it's actually in verse 8, you could retranslate what we have written down as, "This is what I have firmly decided." In the original language, it's actually a little bit confusing knowing how to translate some of those words. It could also say something along the lines of, "I'm not sure what I remember." The king doesn't know. He's unsure of something. And so it could be interpreted that way. But the question I would have, if he forgot the dream, why is he troubled by it? Why is he troubled? Why does he have so much angst about it if he doesn't know anything about the dream? And then if he told them that he doesn't remember the dream, why do all of the astrologers and the Chaldeans and these people, why do they say, "Tell us the dream," over and over and over again to him? Why are they asking him to do that if he's also said, "I don't remember it"? They wouldn't keep asking, right? So what's the other plausible explanation of why the king wants them to tell him about his dream? It's that he doesn't believe them. He doesn't believe them. He actually thinks that everything that they're doing is fake. And he probably has a little bit of history with them because he's probably gone to them before and been given advice about what he needed to do in order to move the country forward. And so he's probably had instances where something that they predicted didn't come true or didn't come fully true. And so he has doubts about all of these people and their understandings of the Babylonian gods and what was necessary for him as a leader of the country. He doesn't believe them. He knew how fake it was. And it's why he said in verse 9, "You have conspired to tell me misleading and wicked things." It's almost like a statement about the past and the present, because he's calling them out. This is not real. But the problem with this isn't just simply that he doesn't believe them. They are really the people that help him understand who God is and his purpose of life is. And so the Babylonians believed in a plethora of gods and took people all sorts of directions in order to find their purpose in life and how to move forward. And so I think the problem is not simply that he doesn't believe them. The problem is that he's an atheist in Babylonian terms. He doesn't really think God exists because the examples he's been given about who God is have fallen short of the desire that he had for life. And so I think he's overcome with anxiety because here he has this dream that reveals that his life is about to fall apart. At least that's what he's thinking. And he's thinking, like, all of this power that I have, this military victories that I have, he's the most powerful man in the world at this time. And he's sitting around looking at everything that he's built in his life and wondering, is this it? Is this all there is? All these guys, they don't have anything to offer me. And all of this isn't really fulfilling. So what else is there? And he's riddled with angst and anxiety. I think that's what the point was. Why did he want them to interpret the dream for him? So that he could expose all of this and try and find some other way to make a sense for his life. What we're seeing through Nebuchadnezzar is God is using the king, the leader of the system, to break down the system. It all is falling apart right here in Daniel chapter 2. And Daniel is, through this, given an opportunity to reveal the one true God. Well, the story actually gets a little bit even harder at this point when the king issues the decree, which is really in the middle of the section that we looked at. Because not only does the king say, "All of you who are present before me, I'm going to kill you. I'm going to kill all of the wise men," which included the guys that had just graduated from the training program, Daniel and his three friends. And so Arioch, who's the commander of the guard, somehow gets connected with Daniel, and Daniel's all confused about what is happening. And it says there in the middle of that story, Daniel spoke to Arioch with wisdom and tact. His life is being threatened. He's being told, "I'm coming to kill you." And Daniel spoke with wisdom and tact. Just amazing. I don't know about you, but if my life was on the line, I'd be yelling and screaming, right? Not speaking with wisdom and tact. He responded with calmness. And I think it really did make all the difference. And then Daniel asked for something truly unthinkable. He asked to go before the king. He shows up to the king and he asks for more time. Now, just remember, probably mere minutes before this, the magicians and the astrologers tell the king, we can't interpret the dream because we don't know what the dream was. And what's the first thing the king says? You're just trying to gain more time. You just want more time. Daniel comes to the king and says, I need more time. And the king says, okay. The astrologers go before the king and say, we can't do this. He says, oh, you want more time? I'm going to kill you. Why the different reaction? The king accepts this one and rejects this one. Why does he react differently? Well, it's something like maybe a lesson your mom taught you. How you say something matters more than what you say. Oftentimes, that is true, right? Daniel speaks with wisdom, with calmness, with tact. These astrologers speak with criticism. Nobody can do what you ask. One is accepted, the other is rejected. You could also say it this way. Often the medium with which we communicate becomes the message. It becomes the message that is received. Now and then I'll walk around downtown, Salem, Portland, larger cities, and there'll be somebody with like a megaphone who's shouting like, Jesus is Lord and you need Jesus. And I'm kind of like, well, yeah, I agree. But you want to know what? I never, ever notice anybody stopping to talk with that kind of person. Ever. Never. They're just shouting at people and nobody is choosing to listen. Now, why is that? Well, it's because the medium is kind of a contradiction of the message. Here we are saying, God loves you and he wants to be close to you. He wants relationship with you and Jesus made a way and it's amazing. Yet I'm yelling with a megaphone at you. One is kind, the message, but the way it's given, the medium, seems to contradict the message. Compare that to, I don't know how many of you have ever talked to the gospel guy in downtown Salem or have ever walked by him. He invites you, he and the people that work with him, invites you into a conversation, usually with a question, and talks kindly. There's no megaphones, there's no microphones, just talking to people. So if you ever walk by the gospel guy, give him a little pat on the back and say, you're doing a good job. Because what he's doing is he's allowing the message and the medium of the message to really be together, inviting people into something. And so after Daniel hears about the decree, he goes to his three friends and he says, this is a time of crisis. We're about to die. And what do? They pray. They pray. Is that always our inclination when we're facing a crisis? Usually it's like to try and figure out the solution, right? We can do this ourselves. Daniel goes to prayer. Daniel knew that the only way he was going to get what he needed in order to stay alive was through prayer. It was only going to be through the mercy of God who was giving him something that he could not do on his own. And that changes everything. Because what happens in the middle of their nighttime prayer is God reveals the dream to Daniel. God reveals it. And what does Daniel do immediately after is revealed? He runs to the king, right? And he tells him exactly what his dream is. And then they have a celebration dinner. No, that's not it actually at all. God reveals the dream. And the first thing that Daniel and his friends do is praise God. And they say about God, wisdom and power are his. He reveals deep and hidden things. In times of blessing, we are often quick to celebrate and slow to praise. And Daniel gives us this example of coming before the Lord and responding to him and what he's done first. Not only does Daniel, in the dream, or after receiving the dream, praise God, he goes to Arioch and he says, I know the dream, take me to the king. Now notice the interaction between the king and these two men. First, Arioch comes to the king and he says, I have found a man among the exiles from Judah who can tell the king what his dream was. And the king asks Daniel if this is true. And Daniel says in verses 27 and 28, no wise man, enchanter, magician, or diviner can explain to the king the mystery he has asked about. Nobody can do this. But there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries. And so I consider this part of the story the but God part of the story. But God. Think about Arioch here. He says, I have found a man. And Daniel says, there is a God. One man champions his own accolades and abilities. The other says, this isn't me. This is God. And points to him. It reminds me of Ephesians 2, 1 through 5, my favorite passage in the Bible. Paul writes, he says, "As for you, you were dead in your transgressions and sins, in which you used to live, when you followed the ways of this world and of the ruler of the kingdom of the air, the spirit who is now at work in those who are disobedient. All of us also lived among them at one time, gratifying the cravings of our flesh and following its desires and thoughts. Like the rest, we were deserving of wrath. We were dead. That's our fate. That's our path. But because of his great love for us, God, who is rich in mercy, made us alive with Christ, even when we were dead in transgressions. It is by grace you have been saved." In verse 4, which reads, "But because of his great love for us, God," in the original language, is just dtheos in the Greek. But God. You were dead, but God. This is your fate, but God. And so I think about Daniel. His back's against the wall. He has nowhere to go except at the mercy of the Lord, but God shows up. And Nebuchadnezzar, whose life feels like meaningless despite all of his success, who's find no viable explanation through the gods that have been presented to him throughout his life, God shows up, but God. And I think our world is in a very similar place to where King Nebuchadnezzar found himself, seeking all these different ways to find purpose and meaning and satisfaction in life and finding it empty. Empty and not satisfying. We can achieve all the success that this world has to offer and still feel like our life is meaningless and pointless. I think of the example of Justin Bieber, actually, as I think about this. He was in a cover story for GQ magazine this summer talking about his past drug addictions and now his faith in Christ. And here's how he described the emptiness that he had in life. In the middle of this magazine article, he said, "There was a sense of still yearning for more. It was like I had this success, and it was still like I'm still sad, and I'm still in pain, and I still have these unresolved issues, and I thought all the success was going to make everything good. And so for me, the drugs were a numbing agent just to continue to get through." Charles Taylor, in his book, A Secular Age, describes this emptiness very similar. As you seek after all these things that our world has to offer, he says, emptiness, there's an emptiness to the repeated, accelerating cycle of desire and fulfillment in consumer culture. What he's saying is that we have these desires for happiness, for meaning and satisfaction, and there's all these ways that our world says you can seek after them and find them right here. And we find that the fulfillment is just not quite good enough. So what do? We go to it for a little bit more, and a little bit more, and a little bit more, and needing just a little bit more of a hit. And we find it's not quite enough, and so we need more. He says there's an emptiness to that repeated, accelerating cycle of seeking after these things that were never meant to bring the fulfillment that we think that they might have to offer. And so I think often happens, like with King Nebuchadnezzar, is that we like build domes over our lives where we shut God out. We don't need him. We can find food for today, and you know, we can find things that'll make us happy for right now. We don't need God, especially in the 21st century here in America. We are our own God. And so we build this dome over our lives. But sometimes, some ways, but God breaks through. His light shines, breaks through that dome that we've created, shines down into our lives. I think that's what happens with Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar. But God, he shows up in mighty ways. And so I said at the beginning that, you know, we couldn't just do outreach by just bringing people closer to the message of Jesus. It had to be something totally different. It's not proximity. We don't just need to bring people closer. We need a whole different presence. God is using us just like he used Daniel to be a bearer of a message. But it's Daniel's presence, his conduct, his character, that really make the difference in allowing Nebuchadnezzar to hear what he has to say. And I think it's the same for us. It's not just about bringing people closer to the message of Jesus. It's allowing God to use us as conduits of his presence to announce his reign in our world. And so what does that look like? I just have two brief thoughts based on the story from Daniel that I think really highlight the way that Daniel pursues this with Nebuchadnezzar. The first is an openness to discuss the dominant narratives of our time. An openness to discuss the dominant narratives of our time. What are those dominant narratives? Well, you could probably name some of them. The things that are against the gospel, but our world believes. The things like, do what makes you happy. That's a dominant narrative of our time. Obey yourself first. You are your own God. Do what makes you feel good. Those are kind of some of the dominant narratives of our time. And so we have to be willing to talk about these from a Christian perspective in a way that says, you know, I actually believe differently. And here's why. And here's why I think, you know, that might feel good in the moment, but is ultimately going to come up empty. We need to be willing to talk about money and gender and sex and all the ways that our world pursues meaning and satisfaction and continues to come up empty. We have to talk about why there's a different way and be open to talking about that. That's what Daniel did with Nebuchadnezzar. He said, there's got to be another way. All these guys, they can't solve this for you, but there is a God. And he was willing to engage Nebuchadnezzar on the main issue that he was focused on at the time. And the second is this, patience. Patience. You're not God. You're not God. We point to him, but God is the one that is at work. We're simply faithful to him. One of the things that I think is easily lost in really the whole story of Daniel is how much time passes between events. Between Daniel 1 and Daniel 2, 3 years take place. Daniel didn't show up in Babylon and he says, you know what, all those astrologers and the magicians and everybody, they're liars. They don't know what they're doing. He probably would have been killed on the spot, right? He was patient and he waited for the moment when God revealed something to him that he could use to be a blessing to the king and to announce who God truly was. And so he was patient. And I think so often we think like right here and right now, God needs to move in this relationship, this friendship I have, and we come up empty and feeling like we fell short. We just have to be willing to be faithful and patient. In many ways, I think in our society today, announcing that Jesus is Lord is a more difficult endeavor because there are so many more people that have no context for a world in which God exists. They have no context for that. But I remain convinced that a world with God will always come up empty. Everybody pursuing life in that way will always come up empty. And it's those of us that are willing to gracefully engage the dominant narratives of our time with patience, we can become a presence that allows people to move closer to the truth of Jesus as Lord. I want to invite the worship team to come up as we take some time to respond. Every Sunday, we like to partake in communion as this reminder that God speaks through his word to us, and we receive that, but his word really demands a response from us. Whether we've been a believer for 50 years or we're not a believer at all, his word demands a response from us. And one of the ways that we as believers partake in responding to God is by coming to the table. And so we have tables up here, up front, and in the back. I heard a pastor recently share that all religious beliefs, and I think you could include secularism as a belief, everybody puts their faith in something. Everybody puts their faith in something. And so all religious beliefs, including atheism and secularism, they're putting their belief in something. And it's like what he described as we're all learning how to swim. And we have instructors who are in a boat riding along next to us. The difference with Christianity between all the other religions is that our instructor gets in the water. And he says, you know what? You can't swim, but I'll swim for you. And so what we're invited to do is to partake in what God has done for us that we can't do for ourselves. That's the message of the Christian faith. That's the message that Nebuchadnezzar was slowly beginning to receive from Daniel.
It's been so good to be together this morning to worship God, to be nourished by his word, to share in fellowship as a community. And we think this is great, this gathering here. We really want more and more as people are feeling led and open to it to come. But we don't even think this is the end of the whole deal. We think another very valuable step is a connection with a few others in a home or a...
Before they leave, though, I want to just highlight, there, if you'd like to be a part of a small group at all, we have them mostly in the evenings, although some are during the day. I'm starting one this Wednesday, 10 o'clock in the morning, right here. If you'd like to be a part of that, let me know. But if that doesn't work, just the connection card on the back of the chair there, just let us know. You'd I get so choked up when I talk about this. Let us know that you'd like to entertain the possibility. What are the options? And I'd love to talk to you about some of those options for these groups represented here. This Wednesday night, we have a small group setting right in this room. We turn the chairs around. We focus on the middle of the auditorium here. The lights go down dim. Music quietly playing in the background for our 4610 experience, which means be still and know He is God. The only thing you need to bring are your prayer requests. You don't even have to pray aloud, but just come and join us for an hour to be refreshed. Perry.
Yeah. All right, friends, we've enjoyed being together, and now don't rush out. Say another long hello to each other, but God bless you and have a great week.